Today on Maine Calling, pet care and veterinary advice. It's estimated that about two-thirds of American homes have a pet. The most popular pets are dogs, in second are cats. No surprise there. And it is no surprise that many households gained a pet or two during the pandemic. It all adds up to a lot of love, but also a lot of furry souls to take care of. That's where our veterinarians come in. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, two veterinarians join us to talk about what maladies they are seeing in their patients right now, what diseases to look out for, and the latest advances in medical treatments for pets. But they are mainly here to answer your questions about taking care of Fido, Pickles, Baxter, and Fluffy. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working this summer to purchase and protect the historic Morris Farm in Wiscasset. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org. By Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Our pets can't really tell us what's wrong when they don't feel well. My guests today are not mind readers, but they are trained to figure it out and heal those four-legged family members. Joining me today, Dr. Ezra Steinberg, who is a veterinary surgeon at Maine Veterinary Medical Center, and Dr. Ai Takeuchi, who is a veterinarian with the Lucerne Veterinary Hospital. We invite you to share your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And I will make a note that often we have many, many calls and questions for these shows with our veterinarian friends. And so you might want to make sure you get your question in early and not wait till the end. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, and our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. And I'm sorry, we have the wrong location for you, Dr. Takeuchi, your Eastern Maine Emergency Veterinary Clinic. I apologize for that error. But let me start with you and ask you, what are you seeing recently? Is there anything sort of new going on out there in the dog and cat community? Dr. Takeuchi.
Well, on the emergency side, one of the most surprising things this summer is I had two heartworm positive cases in Maine dogs, and I've been practicing in Maine for about 10 years, and I've probably only had one or two in the last 10 years, so to have two in one summer was pretty surprising for me.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's twofold. One is that I think we're adopting a lot of pets out of kill shelters from the southern states, and they may be bringing up heartworms to this area. We also are seeing a rise of tourism, so there may be some southern dogs coming up with their owners to visit Bar Harbor, Baxter State Park, those places, and they're bringing up heartworms with them. And I also think we're seeing a rise in just vectors. So mosquitoes are more common, you know, and heartworms are transmitted by mosquitoes, not ticks, but we're also seeing a huge rise in tick-borne disease as well.
Okay, Dr. Steinberg, Ezra, what about you? What are you seeing right now in August of 2024?
Yeah, so what's interesting is, so there are some things in veterinary medicine that are historically seasonal, such as porcupine quills, which I'm sure I see a ton of them. We at MVMC on an emergency basis, like if it's like a sort of rainy, warm summer evening when people are letting their dogs out right before bed, we will sometimes see five or six dogs come in from separate families with quills all over their face. Some of them have two quills in their face. Some of them have hundreds and hundreds to the point where the dog's face is not recognizable. So that's something that we see that just has a peak in this season, then you'll see a couple off season. We've also seen this run of abscesses, so localized infections like around the face and the neck. And we've always seen this peaking in August, but this year has been out of control. We've probably seen 15 a week for the past 3 weeks, and these can be scary because they can swell up and cause interference with an animal able to breathe or swallow. So we treat them pretty aggressively, but it's wild, and we commonly don't find a cause for it. We assume that maybe dogs are outside a lot, like in the spring, chewing on sticks, and it can cause a little puncture wound in the back of the throat that doesn't cause a problem at that time and then takes a couple months to fester. But yeah, it's interesting, and we're ready for them. Like once we start seeing a rise in these things, we expect them to come in through the door.
I want to go back and ask you about porcupines, Ezra. My dog chased a porcupine up a tree recently. Terrifying. Felt like it was a really close call. What is it that happens? Are dogs just curious and they go right up to the porcupine and try to play with it? I mean, what is the interaction that you hear over and over again?
Yeah, I mean they're fascinating creatures actually, and I think the only thing that can really take them out are cars and fisher cats. But you know, if a dog gets into an interaction with a raccoon or a woodchuck or something like that, you might see a bite or two, but it just might grab that animal and then the animal gets away. But a porcupine, they go and they get after it and they don't give up. And so the second they try to bite them, the quills do not shoot like we thought they did in cartoon representations of these animals, but they release easily and they make them stand up, so they penetrate the skin easily. And then, so you know, somebody tries to, if there's two or three on a dog's face, like I'm all for somebody just trying to pull them out at home, but often there's way too many and they get inside the mouth, in the back of the throat. So on day zero, you can see all of them, but sometimes if it takes a couple hours for the animal to get here, they've already started migrating under the skin. They have this one-way motion, so they go in, but they don't come out because of a barb on them. And so if you wait a night or you have a long drive here, some of them have disappeared. And then, you know, we do our best to get them out. Sometimes they are under anesthesia for hours and hours, and we're doing these tiny little incisions. They're called cut down incisions to try to get them from beneath the skin because our best chance to get them is right away. And then there's a window where they're kind of doing okay for a bit. And then we'll see a handful a year that come in because they have some trouble breathing. And what has happened is these quills migrated through the chest wall into the lungs. And then they cause what's called a pneumothorax. So when we say a dropped lung, like basically there's a hole in the lung leaks air into the chest space, and then they have trouble breathing. So the only way to get them out is with what's called a thoracotomy. So it's an open chest surgery. And I've pulled like dozens of them out of lungs and the heart and the big vessels in the chest. Knock wood, they're infrequently fatal if people get attention quickly. But they are nasty animals, those porcupines, and it is wise to keep your dog on a leash if they are curious.
And the whole time Dr. Steinberg's been talking, Dr. Takeuchi, you've been nodding and nodding. This is something you've seen a lot, porcupine quills. I mean, this is Maine. Dogs love to run through the woods. It's a big issue, huh?
It is, and we see a ton of it. We're the furthest north clinic in the state, so we'll see them from as far north as like Presque Isle and Lubeck. And by the time they get to us, they're soft. When you pull them out, sometimes pus is coming out of the hole. And like Ezra said, they're barbed, so it hurts to have them pulled out. And contrary to myth, please do not trim them. We've had a lot of people think that you trim them to let the air out, and that is a myth. It makes it so much harder for us to pull them out because now we're looking for tiny little needles instead of big needles. And if they're in the chest or abdomen, that can turn into that life-threatening emergency. Ezra actually fixed a couple of my patients this year and last year. They were poking the lungs, the gallbladder, free-floating in the abdomen. And these people, one was from the Bar Harbor area, drove to us. We saw what was happening, pulled everything that we could, but I could just feel them getting sucked into the abdomen and chest. So they went straight down, and Ezra fixed him the next day, and the dog was fine. But that was a quick acting owner, and it still resulted in a pretty massive surgery. So leash walk at dawn and dusk, look outside, turn on the lights. Porcupines don't care about fences. And some dogs do not learn. We had the same dog come in 3 nights in a row.
Oh my gosh.
So he did not learn, and I guess mom and dad didn't learn either.
Oh, wow. And so what would be, I mean, how many are you seeing? I mean, are you seeing five a season, five a week? What, how
Oh
many per
no, I think our worst night this summer, we had 13 or 14 in one shift. So in a 12-hour period, we had 13 to 15, and we have to do them in order of severity. So if they're in near the eye, you know, I've had a couple where it's punctured the eye or the eyelid. Those would go before those that just have a couple in their lip. But at any given time on the weekends, we usually have 3 to 5 quill dogs waiting to be sedated. And on busy weekends, we have a quill team who their job is just to grab, knock them down, pull them out, recover them, and go out and get the next one. And that's on top of our critical emergencies or just your run-of-the-mill urinary tract infection. So, if one takes 3 to 4 hours, it can really bog down my team.
My
goodness.
which is not uncommon. It's not uncommon to have like four technicians and two docs pulling them out at a time, and that's a lot of manpower to consume.
Yeah, and we're trying to be fast and quick because literally every time the dog takes a breath under sedation, you can see the quills moving deeper.
So you all, I don't want to talk about porcupine quills for this entire program, but this is all fascinating to me. So Ezra, really, it's not an okay idea to leave them. If your dog gets quilled and you get a couple, you can't like leave them and think, oh, tomorrow or the
I
next day, or they'll work their own way out.
strongly advise against it. And even when we do our job and pull every single one that we possibly can, owners are calling for days or weeks saying, oh, I just pulled a couple more that were working, like they work their way in and they're working their way back out. You have dogs that are like limping chronically. And the most frustrating thing for us as clinicians is MRI and CT are not even great at finding them. Like we'll CT them at times and you see the tract of one and you think that it's it, and you go after it. And it's just like, well, no, a quill has been there and there's inflammation around this area, but it's already moved on. So they are evasive. Yeah, they're wild creatures, those porcupines. I'm not surprised that they have continued to stay on this planet because they're dangerous. But it's wild. It's also weird that dogs don't learn at all. It doesn't make sense.
So I'm going to go from one lovely topic to another. Sarah has sent us an email about hairballs. I would like a short discussion on hairballs, how they form, how cats anatomically hold on to them before eliminating, when and how often to give lubricant. I brush our cats, but if I do or if I don't, my cats get frequent hairballs. You want to take this one?
Sure. So this is a great question because I think there's a myth that people think it's normal for cats to vomit. And I will ask owners, you know, how does your cat vomit? And they're like, no, they don't. And then I'm like, well, what about hairballs? And they're like, oh yeah, one or two a day. And I'd like to rephrase that it may not be the hairball that's causing the vomiting, and it's actually not normal for cats to be vomiting that frequently. And yes, hair is not digestible, especially long-haired cats. If they're grooming themselves, they can get hairball foreign bodies. You know, they can get stuck. I've actually had to pull out like a huge hair mat as an obstructive item out of the colon for constipation or the intestines as an actual blockage. But those are rare, And if your cat is vomiting like once or twice a week, you probably should do a gastrointestinal workup. There was a study done almost like 20 years ago now, but Texas A&M paid for biopsies, ultrasound, GI panels for every cat that came in for either vomiting, decreased appetite, weight loss or diarrhea or any combination of that. And the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine did a study, and 98% of those cats who vomited actually had a diagnosable gastrointestinal disease. So I would like to say, you know, hairballs can happen. It's terrible, especially if you wake up first thing and you step in a pile of it. It is terrible. But if your cat is bringing up multiple hairballs a week, instead of giving them, you know, something to ease that through their GI tract, I would strongly recommend a gastrointestinal workup, because it could be a sign of inflammatory bowel disease or other gastrointestinal disease that it's kind of a symptom of, and we're attributing it to hairballs, and that it's actually masking an actual diagnosis.
So is for a cat who's healthy and they're mm-hmm. grooming themselves, will the hair that they ingest just pass through their system normally?
Normally, the amount that they're grooming should not be enough to cause an obstruction. And, you know, the long hair cats, I think there is a little bit of a caveat if they're molting their and you need to brush them. But overall, I would like to say that the vomiting may be caused by something other than the hairball. And if the other thing that people will also say is that my cat is trying to vomit up a hairball all the time. It sounds like they're bringing something up, but nothing actually comes up. And that is actually a feline asthma cough. So if you are hearing what sounds like a hairball coming up, but your cat's not bringing something up, that could actually be a feline asthma cough. So I think hairballs are sometimes attributed for a lot of other medical issues. So I would encourage follow-up with your regular vet, because it could be feline asthma or it could be inflammatory bowel disease.
All right. Well, we are talking. Go ahead, Ezra.
They also, like, some cats are excessively grooming due to some other, like, so hyperthyroidism. So an overactive thyroid can make a dog, can make a cat excessively groom. I've also seen cats and dogs eat human hair from like the trash can in the bathroom. Somebody cleans out their brush and puts hair. So you pull it out and you're like, this is a different color than the animal that ate it. But yeah, I've seen a bunch of hairball obstructions recently. And I think the original question is like, how often should we add a lubricant? I mean, we have some people that shave their cats because they continue mm-hmm. to get hairball obstructions. And then the laxatone thing. So there's a product called laxatone. And there's dietary formulas. I don't really have too much experience. We always say it, but these are supplements. You know, it's not like an actual approved drug. So we don't really know the efficacy of it. I tell people you can definitely try it. But like I said, it's a workup, because like we talked about GI disease, we talked about endocrine disease. Like there could be many other causes of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've talked about porcupines, so we've talked about hairballs. We need to take a break. We are speaking with two veterinarians and answering your pet questions. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566 and our email address talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are talking about pet care. Joining me, two veterinarians, Dr. I. Takeuchi with Eastern Maine Emergency Veterinary Clinic and Dr. Ezra Steinberg with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Ask your question by email. That's talk@mainepublic.org, or comment on Facebook or Instagram. An email here from Madison. I recently adopted a puppy. He is a mutt, but we think Great Pyrenees. He's big at 15 weeks old. He loves jumping up to the edge of the counter. Any tips on keeping him from jumping up? We keep food and fun things away from the edge so there's no temptation. Who wants to tackle that one? Dr. Takeuchi? Hey. Or Dr. Steinberg? Go ahead.
I'll start by saying, hey, Madison, if you figure out a way to stop that, let me know, because my dog does it too. Yeah, I mean, that's tough. Puppies are puppies, and there's only so much you can do. I definitely say if you really want to invest in this dog, it's worth looking at getting a trainer to help you out with stuff because it's not always intuitive. And do your research on dog trainers because there's many different schools of thought. There are like as many different opinions on how to train a dog as any other topic of medicine. But that is a really, really tough one. You know, in the veterinary field, like trained veterinarians are usually of the belief of positive reinforcement when it comes to training. And a side note is that I am not a dog trainer or a behaviorist. I actually outsourced my own for my own dog. But you know, the when a dog jumps on the counter, the negative reinforcement of like spraying them with water or shaking a jar of coins is not widely accepted by most, but that is a really, really tough one. I would also put a plug if you have a very, very large dog, I would also put a plug in for thinking about insurance, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit, but it's a good idea with a puppy because the sooner you get the policy, the less expensive it is.
Okay, we're going to go to Pete calling from South Portland. Hi, Pete, go ahead.
Hi, I had a question about, you know, the price of veterinary service has gone, like when you were talking about pulling out those from a porcupine, I can just imagine if I wouldn't be able to afford to have that done. It just hearing you say it, it just sounds like God, that's got to be so expensive. And I'm an economist, and I've seen a lot of veterinary services being bought up by private equity firms and forcing the prices. You know, over the last 5 years, it's just remarkable how much more expensive it's got. Do you have anything to say? You know, I have two dogs. I actually have a Great Pyrenees and a Weimaraner. We take really good care of them, but, you know, it gets worrisome that, because they're both rescues. And, you know, it's kind of hard. Something you'd like to rescue, but, you know, if you rescue something, you could be rescuing a problem. Because last Pyrenees I had, the first month we had it, it cost us $3,700. And they died 3 months later. And the vet
was
like, oh,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, Pete, I really appreciate you calling. It's so interesting that you're an economist as well as a dog owner. And I want to ask the two veterinarians here. I don't think it's any secret that a lot of veterinary practices are being sold to, you know, they're not, most are not anymore small local practice hanging out your shingle, are they? Is that the cause of the rising costs?
So I will say, yeah. So we have I've worked for a corporate before. We've been under private ownership in the past, and yeah, Pete, the prices have increased dramatically. Porcupine quilling could be anywhere from $800 all the way up to these dogs that needed chest surgery, $20,000. When all is said and done. I think my answer to that is I'm not sure how much private equity's influence has caused the increase in prices. Even when you compare so we are partnered with a corporation, and it's a local group called Rare Breed out of Portland. And when you compare our prices to any like hospitals, so even if it's privately owned, and by private, I mean not with a corporation, not that it's not publicly traded, but when you compare prices to a like-to-like hospital, they're pretty darn similar. And I think that the benefits that you get out of corporate ownership are better purchasing prices for products. So because you can scale, these other companies, these pharma companies, and all of our other suppliers will give you better prices. Benefits are better, tech salaries are better. So, you know, have costs in veterinary medicine risen in the past 4 years? 100%. I mean, it's like our prices have gone up on basic surgeries, maybe 30%. But if you look around, everything else has as well. So all of our costs have gone up. I mean, at the supermarket, it's out of control. So the comment about rescuing a dog and then not having money to pay for it, I think your only answer is really insurance. And it's the same thing with a vehicle. You know, you get a vehicle for an inexpensive amount, and then all of a sudden you need a bunch of work. And you don't have, you know, you say, well, I got the car for cheap, but I don't have money to fix it. So it's the same thing. And I don't want to seem insensitive, but it stresses the importance of having either a savings account that is ready there for any unexpected emergency, or insurance takes that guesswork out of it. And as long as you can afford the premium, it makes healthcare relatively affordable. And unfortunately, it's starting to sound like human medicine. But that's just the way it is when you're trying to grow and expand and offer the best services and state-of-the-art care.
And there are so many more insurance options than there used to be in terms of pet insurance. Correct. Yeah. So Pete, thank you for calling in and raising a question that a lot of people have. I want to go here to oh boy, where'd that email go? This is fun. From Pat. I have two lab mixes, ages 5 and 2. They are high energy and frequently run full speed on the beach, swim in the ocean and river, hike and play fetch in the backyard. What is a good rule of thumb time frame to wait after their meals before exercising so we can avoid bloat or stomach twisting? We had an older lab die of that many years ago, so it is a concern. They get 1.5 cups of kibble with a spoonful of wet food and pumpkin for each meal. Would it be helpful to split their meal and give them half before exercise and half after? Dr. Takeuchi, do you have an opinion about how, the time frame between
So I usually say wait at least a half hour to an hour for exercise, but I also really believe in preventative care for gastric dilation and volvulus or bloat. So you can actually do a preventative surgery where at the time of spay or neuter, you can have your veterinarian, and if they're not able to do it, refer it to a veterinarian such as Dr. Steinberg, where they can pexy or suture the stomach into place. So even if it bloats, it can't twist. When it twists, that's when it cuts off the blood supply. And it's not a fail safe. It can bloat enough to compress the blood vessels, but the gastropexy at the time of spay or neuter would be highly recommended in dogs with risk, such as Great Danes, German Shepherds, Burmese Mountain Dogs, Standard Poodles, Labradors. And if you are nervous about having, a male dog, you don't go into the belly. So you have to kind of weigh the pros and cons of that. But there is laparoscopic assisted, where it's very small, like not even 1 inch incisions. So the recovery is much easier. So exercising at least 30 to 60 minutes after eating, feeding from a raised bowl to avoid gulping of the air, slowing their feeding down, and feeding two small meals versus two, like one large meal a day is recommended. But Ezra probably does a lot of these gastropexies in these big dogs, so he might have some comments too.
We do them laparoscopically. So, I mean, of course, there's a cost involved. Unfortunately, insurance doesn't usually cover the prophylactic gastropexy, which is really frustrating because that is a fraction of the cost of having it done at 2 in the morning when the dog comes in with bloat. And for the listeners out there that didn't catch exactly what this is the stomach gets really big and then it twists around. And like I said, it is definitely a breed thing. All these other things about when they're eating and how they eat, it's none of them are really proven consistently. The one thing that we really count on is dogs that have a first degree relative that have had this problem, they have a much higher risk. So if you rescue a dog, that's really tough. But if you know the lineage of the dog, it's something that you should ask the breeder, is this in the line? And it's not a deal breaker. If they've had it in the line, you can still get the pet, but I would absolutely recommend having that gastropexy performed, and you can talk to your vet about that.
We'll go to Carol, who's calling from Porter. Hi, Carol, go ahead.
Hi. I am curious to know if there is any more updated information on felines, your domestic feline, indoor, outdoor cats, and tick-borne disease.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. More and more, it seems as though there are more and more tick-borne diseases in humans every year. What do we know about cats?
So there is actually a fatal tick-borne disease present in the United States, but I don't believe it's been documented in this area of the country. It's more like Tennessee, Missouri, that sort of area. So it's not here yet, and cats are more resistant to getting tick-borne disease for some reason. So Lyme is more common in dogs and cats, but it's not that they can't get it. And they are more prone to flea diseases. So there is a red blood cell parasite that fleas can give cats. So flea and tick prevention is important, even in indoor cats, if you're an avid hiker or they even go on your porch or your dog, you have a dog. Flea and tick prevention is still important. And although we haven't seen any of these, the fatal tick-borne disease in Maine, we never saw Ehrlichia or Anaplasma before. So it's probably on its way here. We just don't know when.
Carol, thanks for the question. An email here from Nicole. We were already talking about pet insurance. Nicole says, we are looking into pet insurance for our Sphinx cats since the company we previously used is no longer offered in Maine. Do you have recommendations on how to best narrow down the choices or even recommendations or ones to avoid for specific companies? Ezra, I know you probably don't want to sort of
I
recommend
you know
just
what?
one, but
Yeah.
what advice would you give
Yeah,
Nicole?
I'm not gonna say the names of any, but yeah, Maine has done something different in terms of the regulations with insurance. And like if you have a Maine address as your home address versus a half mile down the road in New Hampshire, you're gonna be offered different policies, but there's really no way around that. I think that insurance is kind of tailored to your needs and your goals and expectations in terms of is it more for catastrophic issues, which I that's my main recommendation. When people ask me about insurance, I say to them, like, this is not for your cat or dog gets a little laceration and needs to go to the ER and has an, yes, I'm going to say $800 bill because that it can even cost that. I'm talking a broken leg, an ACL tear, a foreign body, a bloat, a massive porcupine quilling, where the invoice could be in the upwards of $10,000. So I don't think it's worth paying a high amount to have a low deductible. So I know insurance talk gets confusing, but deductible is the amount that you are responsible be for before the insurance kicks in. So I would look into that. There's also some, there's one company out there that doesn't do it by a reimbursement policy. So the majority of policies, all but one of them at this time, you have to pay up front and then the insurance company pays you back. And they usually do it quickly within a couple of weeks, but some people don't have access to that capital. So there's a company that will actually pay the veterinarian directly so you don't have to shell out that money up front, which I think is helpful. But a lot has gone down with the insurance industry. There's one company that dropped 100,000 of their clients, just dropped them and said that you are now without insurance. One of the biggest misconceptions is some people come in and they say, well, my dog, broke its leg when it was younger, so he can't get insurance because he's got a pre-existing condition. Well, all that means is that the insurance company won't insure that exact issue. So if there's a problem with the hardware that was used to repair it, they won't cover that, but they'll cover anything else if there's any respiratory or cardiac issues or any other infectious disease. So just because a dog has had an issue in the past doesn't mean that they are not insurable. And then my final thing is get it sooner rather than later, because all these companies, like if you insure a puppy at 4 months of age over the lifetime of the pet, it is going to be so much less expensive than if you call for insurance around 3 years of age. It's drastic. So I would say don't wait. And then if you have an insurance policy, don't cancel it because you never use it, because inevitably that's when you're going to need it is 2 days after you cancel the policy.
Go
And
ahead, Dr.
I would also say talk to the receptionist at your veterinary clinic. They're usually the ones handling the claims, so they'll tell you who's easy to work with and they have positive experiences with versus what companies give them kind of like the runaround or it takes three reimbursement requests you know, before it happened. So that's also a good resource. The people actually having to process the claims have more insight than the veterinarian sometimes.
I know I keep talking. I have one final thing, and that it's like, you get what you pay for. And there was an article that came out recently that was in the Portland Press. I think it was Portland Press that talked about these different insurance companies, and they had a chart about what the monthly premium was between all these different companies. And one was drastically more expensive than the other ones. But having worked with many of the more affordable or less expensive options, sometimes they don't pay up when it comes time. So I know that the premium can be a deal breaker sometimes, but don't just assume because one is less expensive that it's a better option. And I would argue that it often is not.
All right. Well, on that note, we are going to take another quick break. We're talking about veterinary care on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are talking about pet care. Joining me are two veterinarians, Dr. I. Takeuchi with Eastern Maine Veterinary Clinic and Dr. Ezra Steinberg with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Join our conversation. If you're quick, you can call 1-800-399-3566 or you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram. You know, before we go back to the calls, I just want to ask each of you if there are any advances you're excited about. Is there anything that you can treat now that you couldn't just a few years ago? Dr. Takeuchi.
I think for me, the advancement of being able to have things like ultrasound and digital x-rays in the hospital, you know, that used to be so expensive, we couldn't have that. So we are able to diagnose fluid around the heart, fluid around the lungs, fluid in the belly, tumors before they cause a problem, just with the advanced diagnostics that we can use. So I think that's exciting that we can actually help animals before they're in super dire need. And we can also, we've been diagnosing a lot of anaphylaxis with our ultrasound. So probably saving animals that were in the past probably passing and we had no idea. Now we can do the right things for them.
All right. So I have an email here from Claire. I have heard a fair number of people say that the rescue they adopted had serious health issues, more than expected. Many of these animals had been brought in from the South and people are facing big bills. Dr. Steinberg, you know, a lot of people have a great big heart and they want to adopt a rescue. They want to find a home for an animal that's coming from a kill shelter. Is Claire's experience with her friends, is this, you know, borne out with any data? Is it true that these dogs have more health problems or does it just sort of seem like anecdotal evidence?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, some people can obviously get burned and have a bad experience. The stuff that I was talking about before with heartworm disease, like often when they come from south, like from the south, that is something that maybe the heartworms evaded the first test and then they go for their next annual test and they test positive. So that's like a geographic thing of them coming from down south. I don't know. I mean, I meet plenty of rescue dogs, tons of rescue dogs that have had no problems since adoption. There are some unbelievably wonderful rescue groups around here that take sort of special needs pets, but they usually vet them completely and then come with full disclosure. I don't know any rescues that are giving out animals and trying to hide their problems. At that, most rescues, if somebody brings a pet home and the rescue had only been fostering it for a short time and didn't really know what was going on with it problem has arisen that they weren't expecting, they usually help them out if the rescue is able to do that, if they have the funding for it. So I have been like, there's not one rescue that we work with, and we work with so many of them, that would turn their back on someone. And then there are people out there that only want to adopt an animal with health issues because they just love being caretakers and they find that their home is suitable for it. So I don't know. I mean, yes, you should be able to, I mean, maybe if you were thinking about adopting and you're very concerned about taking on a new problem, I'm sure most rescues would allow you to go get like a physical exam by a vet, borrow the dog for a day, you know, have a little trial period, and then, you know, hopefully find out a little bit more about the pet.
Speaking of people who want to adopt animals with problems, we have an email here from Annie. My partner and I love to adopt older dogs from shelters who need a good home. Currently, we're the parents of a 15-year-old blind and deaf Yorkie, who is also, as he gets older, needing to pee quite often. He's trained on a pee pad, and we try to give him sensory cues to help him find it since he is blind, pheromone-scented pads, putting it on a tray so he can feel where it is. But he often gets confused and goes right on the floor. It is a challenge because we can't give him feedback as he can't hear us. Besides belly bands, are there suggestions you have for how to help him out? Do you have any ideas for Annie?
Yeah, thank you so much for adopting these special needs dogs. They're, people like you just bring kindness and a smile to everyone, really. So thank you for what you do. I would just make sure that this is not a medical issue first. So make sure that you do have a urinalysis and blood work done. It could be a sign of a urinary tract infection, kidney disease. There's a disease called Cushing's disease where they make too much steroids and it makes them drink a lot and pee a lot. So when they realize they have to pee, they can't hold it. So it's not a voluntary accident. So I would get that worked up first. And yes, there are belly bands and things like that, but I would strongly encourage you to make sure that you are not ignoring a medical issue, because it, even though age is a consideration, it's not a disease. So let's make sure we're not missing anything first.
We'll go to Eileen, who's calling from Kittery. Hi, Eileen. Go ahead.
Hi. So I have a good friend who has a cat, originally a rescue cat. She had it for quite some time. And it's had health issues for quite a while now, months. Head shaking, loss of hearing, fur kind of coming out, very, very thin, almost emaciated looking. And I've been trying to encourage her to make an appointment. She has some health issues, so I've offered to make the appointment and bring the cat for her, but so far there's no action.
Eileen, you're hard to hear, something about your connection, but I think what you're asking for is some advice on talking to a friend who you feel as though their animal needs to go to a veterinarian when the animal is not. Am I right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, yeah. Do either of you have some advice? It's a tough situation, a tough conversation to have with a friend.
Yeah, it's really tough. And I think, if you said you were able to convince her to go be seen, I missed out if the cat had already been seen. But that is a totally perfect place to start with your general practitioner. If you could get in there soon, usually with a problem like this, where it seems very obvious if the cat is eating and is emaciated, it seems like it's going to be able to be diagnosed hopefully quickly and painlessly. And it might be something like we talked about before, hyperthyroidism can make a cat really skinny and eat all the time. But there's also chronic kidney disease that makes cats really skinny. And so they'd probably start off with some blood work. And then you work your way up and do some imaging, such as chest x-rays or an abdominal ultrasound. So there's a pretty basic way to start small and then work our way up if we are having trouble getting the diagnosis. But it seems as though, this cat definitely needs some help. And thanks for being an advocate for it.
And what advice do you have for just having that conversation with your friend?
I think if you come from a place of kindness and just say, I'm coming from a place of love for you and your pet, and I want to help both of you. If it's something financial, there are funds through the town. Your animal control officer often has some discretionary funds, especially if it's a rescue. There are some organizations in Maine, and even the original rescue that she got the cat from will sometimes cover the cost to keep the pet in the home. So I would be very honest and genuine and say, this is coming from a place of love, not only for you, but for this cat. And I perceive suffering and that it needs help. And what can I do to get us from point A to B? I'm glad you're being an advocate for both of them.
Eileen, thanks for your call. We'll go up to Denmark, Maine, and Lori. Hi, Lori, go ahead.
Hey there, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My husband and I rescued a Catahoula a few years back, and we didn't have a choice in when he would be neutered. So at 14 weeks, he was neutered. And I do understand that a lot of people don't go through that, so they kind of have to impose that. And he ended up blowing out both back knees, and we, thanks to Portland Veterinary Hospital, we did. They're repaired. He's fully functional, but it was about $10,000. And we've heard a lot of other people having the same problem, and we're wondering, are they neutering too soon? Do they not have that hormonal kind of that chance to really build those strong bones and tendons that will get them not have to have these really expensive surgeries? Not to mention it's so hard on them. The recovery is very long, very lengthy.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I've been there with my own patients, with my own pets, with knee surgeries, and it is not fun. But it's a good question. It's a question that I get asked all the time about when do we spay and neuter our animals. And 14 weeks, yeah, that's super young. And I think that the evidence does not really show that it's going to prevent ACL tears. There's a lot of research going into when to spay or neuter your animal, and does it prevent against cancer? Does it prevent against bone issues and joint issues? And the evidence is not really clear enough to say. There's like one group that's pushing for it, but it's not widely accepted. And especially in the American College of Veterinary Surgeons, it's not completely accepted. So what I usually tell people is like, yes, just my gut, like intuitively, it seems better to wait until an animal is fully developed to take the hormones away from them. But like in the UK and in Europe, there's a lot more animals that are not spayed or neutered, and they have the same amount of ACL tears over there. So I don't think that this did a disservice to your pup. I think that it's just, we see ACL tears all day, every day. And I think that even if he was a mature dog when he was neutered, he still might have wound up with that issue. But it's a great question and one we talk about all the time.
Thank you, Lori. We have an email here from Charlie. We've had a rescue dog for a year and a half. She is sweet, but we have a hard time leaving her alone. She barks a lot, goes to the bathroom, and knocks over stuff in windows. Any suggestions on separation anxiety? And this is a really common question, especially for pandemic puppies, and especially right now as kids who are often dogs' and cats' best friends are going back to school. So we have just a couple minutes left. Tell us what you can about helping prevent and treat separation anxiety.
So sometimes, I'll be honest, you do need some pharmacological intervention. So talking to your veterinarian about starting some mild medications before going back to school or things might be helpful. And sometimes you might need those pharmaceuticals to help with the training process, just to dampen down that fear of anxiety, you know, in their body, so that they can actually train with you. And this is where, you know, do you always fill your coffee mug, pick up your keys, check your bag? Are you actually allowing your dog to ramp up their anxiety? If you switch it up, you don't do your routine, you leave the door, you know, you go and come back outside, or you do the coffee mug, the car keys, and the purse, go outside and come back in. By changing your routine and making it less of like, oh my gosh, every time mom or dad does this thing, they disappear forever and I think they're never coming home. If you can change it up every time and change it so that there is not this like wind up anxiety, that can be helpful. And crate training them, I can't stress enough, a crate is not a prison, it's their safe place. And if you can train them to have a safe place where they are comfortable and they can go to, and I call it my dog's place, I say, go to your place, and he goes, that's where the best treats are, that's where the best bed is. You can kind of change the narrative, but behavior issues, you have to break the habit about 900 times before you make progress. So it'll take some time.
Thank you for that advice. We have about a minute left. I'm going to go to Maura in Tamworth, New Hampshire. Maura, can you ask your question quickly?
Yes, thank you so much, Jennifer. My question is about dogs that are being asked to have their teeth cleaned now. And is that a new thing? And is that necessary? And is it smart to put older dogs under anesthesia for that? Thank you.
That's a great question. And you also are a regular dog tooth brusher, right, Maura?
That's right.
Yeah, which I think most people are not. Who wants good, to take
good,
that?
Good, Ezra? Good for you, Maura. That is amazing. I'm so impressed with people that actually continuously brush their dog's teeth. So, I mean, there's all different ends of the spectrum here in that some dogs can go a lifetime without an anesthetized teeth cleaning, and some dogs come out with huge abscesses from dental disease. So it really depends on the severity of it. But we've been cleaning teeth, anesthetizing dogs and cleaning teeth forever. We just have better technology to diagnose worse periodontal disease. And something that I need to get done for my dog soon too.
Maura, thanks for your call. And thank you for both of you. Dr. Ezra Steinberg, a surgeon at Maine Veterinary Medical Center. And I, Takeuchi, is a veterinarian at Eastern Maine Emergency Medical Clinic. Today's sound engineer was Sam Casey, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. A reminder, our rebroadcasts are now heard each weekday at 8 p.m. If you want to sign up for our newsletter or listen to any old Maine Calling program, you can go to mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.